Hey, I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Rex.
Welcome to the Baked Potato Podcast, where we discuss serial killers, cults, and the like. We just happen to be stoned whilst doing so.
Grab your green and let's get baked. This episode is brought to you by Sour Diesel. Sour Diesel, sometimes called Sour D, is an invigorating sativa-dominant strain named after its pungent diesel-like aroma. This fast-acting strain delivers energizing, dreamy, cerebral effects that have pushed Sour Diesel to its legendary status. Stress, pain, and depression fade away, and long-lasting relief that makes Sour Diesel a top choice among medical patients. This strain took root in the early 90s, and it is believed to have descended from ChemDog 91 and Super Skunk.
I will be having ChemDog, which Leafly says, ChemDog has developed quite the name for itself over the years. Between its mysterious origin, ambiguous genetics, and a plethora of successful crosses the strain has produced, ChemDog has practically secured itself a permanent place in the Cannabis Hall of Fame. The original source of powerhouse strains like Sour Diesel and The original source of powerhouse strains like Sour Diesel and OG Kush, ChemDog is known for its distinct diesel-like aroma. Pungent and sharp, you'll be able to smell this strain from a mile away. Cannabis newbies be warned. ChemDog tends to be very potent. Consumers can expect to have a cerebral experience coupled with a strong, heavy-bodied feeling. We will go to our respective smoking corners, socially distant, of course, and return to tell you stories about some killer couples. We're back and we're baked. And I'm going to start things off by telling you about a killer couple from Canada. They are Carla Homolka and Paul Bernardo. Have you heard of them at all? Does that sound familiar?
No, Lindsay, I've not heard of either of those people. So please, okay, do tell me about them.
Well, this will be a treat for you. They're terrible people. Okay, so Carla Leanne Homolka was the eldest child, born to Carol and Dorothy on May 4th, 1970 in Port Credit, Ontario. She had two younger...
Carol and Dorothy?
Yes, Carol is the man. It's spelled K-A-R-E-L, and Dorothy is the mother. She had two younger sisters, Lori, born in 1971, and Tammy, born in 1975. Her upbringing was fairly uneventful. She was raised in the suburbs of Ontario and had an upper-middle-class lifestyle. She was popular.
The streets of Canada.
Exactly. She was popular and had lots of friends. And she liked to brag about dating older men. That was her thing.
Ooh, how much older?
About 5 years, which isn't terrible, except for she's a child when they meet. So that's a little weird. When Carla was 17.
It was not legal.
See, and this part I'm a little confused about because the documentary I watched had her at 17 when they met. But then, like, an article that I read had her at 18. And I don't know the date that they met. Otherwise, I'd just do the math from her birthday. But so either when she was 17 or 18, they were having drinks at a bar after a convention. Oh, and I forgot to tell you, she works at a pet shop. Okay. So she was at some kind of convention for work. They were at the bar drinking after. The drinking age, you know, is 18 in Canada. So I don't know, she either got in or she was 18. And she was approached by a man named Paul Bernardo. They hit it off and got a hotel room upstairs to hook up. Their relationship started with a lot of lust and stayed based in their sexual activities for the most part. So that's kind of the rock of their relationship is sex.
It's the sex.
Yeah. So let's meet Paul.
Hi, Paul. Welcome to our podcast.
Paul Kenneth Bernardo was born August 27th, 1964. Unlike Carla, Paul was the youngest of three kids. His upbringing was a little more tumultuous. He is said to have had a wealthy yet dysfunctional home life. His father, Kenneth, came from wealth as well. Kenneth's father, which would be Paul's grandfather, was an Italian immigrant that built a very successful marble and tile business in Ontario. And instead of joining the family business, Kenneth became an accountant. And then in 1975, Kenneth, the dad, was charged with child molestation after fondling a girl, and he also sexually abused his own daughter, Paul's sister. After these events, Paul's mother, Marilyn, went into a deep depression and withdrew from the family. She moved down to the basement of their home, and she
Why
had been
raised. Why didn't she call the police?
Well, he was. I don't have that much information on them. I assume the police were called at some point because he was charged.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
I don't know if he was ever charged with his own daughters, but he was charged with the other molestation.
So he molested both of his daughters.
No, he molested a daughter and then also another little girl who wasn't related to them.
Oh, gotcha. That's awful.
It is, yes. So the mother, Marilyn, she had been raised in a stable, wealthy household after being adopted by a Toronto lawyer and his wife as a baby. She married Kenneth in 1960 after her father disapproved of a former boyfriend and she found a winner with Kenneth. So.
The marriage that dad wanted.
Exactly. Despite this, Paul was said to be a polite, well-mannered child. Authors have described him as, quote, good, like a good-looking, cute kid, end quote, etc. On the outside, he seemed to be well-adjusted, but on the inside, he was building up a hatred towards women.
Why was he building that up?
Mommy issues.
Is it from her withdrawing to the basement?
Yeah, but we're about to see a pivotal moment.
Okay.
So when Paul was 16, his mom admitted to him that he was the product of an extramarital affair.
Oh, that is soul crushing.
Yes. So this devastated him. And his reaction was to not only openly insult her, calling her names like slob and whore, but also to start fantasizing about humiliating women. His fantasies got darker and he started being violent with his girlfriends in real life. So by the time he met Carla, he had already left a trail of battered women in his wake. His exes said he was abusive and they broke up after he became too violent during sex.
So he took out his mommy issues on his quote loved unquote ones.
Exactly. So keeping up appearances, Paul attended Sir Wilfrid Laurier Collegiate Institute in Scarborough, then the University of Toronto, Scarborough, by 1982. He earned his degree and seemed like a perfect match for Carla on the outside. He and Carla got along swimmingly, and she was on board with his sex kinks. At this time, Carla lived in St. Catharines, and Paul was still in Scarborough. And then here's where things take a dark turn. By May of 1987, the university and surrounding town of Scarborough were being terrorized by a man they referred to as the Scarborough Rapist. So the women who were attacked were unable to identify the man since he came up from behind at night. He held them at knife point, and if they fought back, he demanded they use derogatory terms to describe themselves for his pleasure. Yeah, it's awful.
That's creepy.
It is. He liked slut, bitch, whore, etc. And then it gets creepier. He also demanded to be called the king.
Narcissist.
Yes, very much. And he's a full-on psychopath. I have the rating somewhere on here on the checklist, but he's like 35 out of 40. He's a full-on psychopath. So the victim said that they could tell he was an attractive man with light hair, but no other identifying details since the crimes took place in the cover of night. The incidents from Paul Bernardo's.
I have a quick question. Was this while he was married to her?
No, they were dating and living in separate towns. He lived in Scarborough and she lived in St. Catharines.
But they were in a relationship.
Yes, they were in a long-term relationship. And her family loved him.
They're going to need some counseling.
Just to get over a little bit.
To get over that little hump.
Oh, yeah. And it gets worse, too. So the known incidents were May 4th, 1987, the rape of a 21-year-old Scarborough woman in front of her parents' house after he followed her home. May 14th, 1987, the rape of a 19-year-old woman in the backyard of her parents' house. And then July 17th, 1987, attempted rape of a young woman. Although he beat the victim, he abandoned the attack when she fought back. And this, I don't know if I said it or not just a second ago, but this is from his Wikipedia. I copied the event so I wouldn't get him wrong. Like, just so this is verbatim from that.
It's nice to cite your sources.
Yeah. Which I do have on the Keefe notes. There's an entire page of my sources.
Perfect transition.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so back to the awful news. September
29th. The good times are over.
Yeah. Sorry. September 29th, 1987, attempted rape of a 15-year-old girl. Bernardo broke into a house in Scarborough and entered the victim's bedroom. He jumped on her back, put his hands over his mouth, threatened her with a knife, bruised the side of her face, and bit her ear.
Ooh, Mike Tyson'd her.
Mm-hmm. And then Bernardo fled when the victim's mother entered the room and screamed. 19 years old at the time of the crime, Anthony Hainemeyer. Hainemeyer? Yeah, Hainemeyer. Anthony Hainemeyer was convicted.
We're gonna get a letter from Anthony Hainemeyer. Like, the fuck did you mispronounce my name for?
Well, he had something way worse than the name being butchered, because he was convicted of that sexual assault in 1989 and served a 16-month prison sentence, but was exonerated after Bernardo admitted to the crime in 2006.
Why did he get pinned for it?
I don't know. That's because he knew the girl, I think, is why they did that.
So he's like the most logical suspect in her universe?
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
That makes sense.
And
I mean, it doesn't make sense, but
in that context,
in that thing, yeah.
Yes. So he was wrongly convicted. Moving on. So December 16th, 1987 was the rape of a 15-year-old girl. The next day, the Metropolitan Toronto Police issued a warning to women in Scarborough traveling alone at night, especially those riding buses. And then December 23rd, 1987, the rape of a 17-year-old girl with a knife used to threaten his victims. At this point, he began to be known as the Scarborough Rapist. And then April 18th of 88, he attacked a 17-year-old girl. May 25th of 88, he was caught by a uniformed Metro Toronto investigator stalking out a bus shelter. Although the investigator noticed Bernardo hiding under a tree and pursued him on foot, he escaped. So...
He outran them?
Yeah, apparently. He can outrun a Mountie, but he was at the bus station creeping on the girls.
Aren't Mounties usually on horses?
That's how I like to picture them, but I don't think that's true most of the time.
That is what Rocky and Bullwinkle taught me, though. It must be true.
It must be. Back to the sad stuff. So then, May 30th of 88, he raped an 18-year-old woman in Mississauga. Ontario, Mississauga. Oh, God, I'm butchering that, too.
Sorry, Mississauga listeners.
Yeah. And that was about 40 kilometers southwest of Scarborough. On October 4th, 1988, there was an attempted rape. Although his intended victim fought him off, he inflicted 2 stab wounds to her thigh and buttocks, which required 12 stitches.
Oh, that's not fun.
Yeah. And then November 16th, 1988, the rape of an 18-year-old woman in the backyard of her parents' house again. He did that a lot.
So and just demoralize them? He got off on that?
Yes. Making them call themselves how he viewed his mother, basically. And he wanted to feel powerful. The Metro Police formed a task force to capture the Scarborough rapist on November 17th of 88. And then December 27th, of 88, there was an attempted rape with a neighbor chasing Bernardo off. And then June 20th, 1989, another attempted rape. The woman fought and her screams alerted neighbors. Bernardo's fled with scratches on his face. And then August 15th, 1989, the rape of a 22-year-old woman. Bernardo stalked her the previous night outside of her window. Outside of the window of her apartment and waited for her to arrive home. And then November 21st, 1989, the rape of a 15-year-old girl he saw in a bus shelter. And then December 22nd, 1989, the rape of a 19-year-old woman. And then this is when they finally stopped. May 26, 1990, the rape of a 19-year-old woman. His victim's vivid recollection of her attacker enabled police to create a computer composite portrait, which was released 2 days later by police and published in Toronto and the area newspapers.
So was it any help?
Yes. So it looked a lot like him. And what happened with that is his friends actually are the ones who called the police. Oh, but during the meantime, Carla and her family had no knowledge of Paul's nighttime activities. They thought he was a well-to-do, educated man on his way to a successful life. And, oh, okay, so in one of the documentaries I watched, he had ambitions to be a rapper. I don't know why, but he did.
Is that what she thought he was doing at night?
She didn't live in Scarborough. They lived in separate cities.
And so she wouldn't have known anyway.
Exactly. And that's how he liked it. At that time, at least. That will change.
Didn't they have telephones? Or she didn't want to come off as too clingy, maybe?
I'm sure they talked to each other on the phone.
Yeah.
But he wasn't like, hey, guess what I just got back from doing? I'll give you a hint. It's not quite legal. Yeah.
On several fronts.
So he is a psychopath, literally, like I was saying. He has been rated 35 out of 40 on the psychopathy checklist, which the psychopathy checklist or Hare psychopathy checklist revised. It's now referred to as the psychopathy checklist revised, PCL-R. And it's a psychological assessment tool most commonly used to assess the presence of psychopathy in individuals. It's a 20-item inventory of perceived personality traits and recorded behaviors intended to be completed on the basis of a semi-structured interview, along with a review of collateral information such as official records. An example, it's been used in shows like Most Evil. Have you ever watched that? It's on Netflix.
I have not watched that, so I have no idea what that's about.
Okay, so Most Evil, they cover different, like, murderers, and they always say, like, they rate them on a scale, but they rate them on the Hare psychopathy checklist. So.
Okay, so I'm interested.
Yeah. It's a good show, but okay. May 29th, 1990. That is 3 days after he had raped the 19-year-old woman who remembered him, and they were able to draw a sketch. Police release a sketch of the Scarborough rapist, and people start to recognize the sketch as Mr. Bernardo's face. Many people, like I said, including his friends, called the police to let them know they think it's Paul Bernardo. He had shared with his friends that he liked rough sex, anal, and analingus, so it didn't seem too far-fetched for them that he was the rapist they're searching for. And then I wrote, that's never good if your friends think you're the profile of a serial rapist.
Based on liking anal.
Yeah, not just that. But if they're like, you know what, that sounds like Paul. That's not a good thing.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot of people that like both rough sex and anal. And
are not
I probably wouldn't assess them as a serial rapist.
Right. What I'm saying is he has other traits that made his friends think, oh, that's him.
They could, like, something's a little off. Like, yes. His psychopathy and his narcissism shines through.
Exactly.
Okay.
So he was called to the station for questioning and submitted a blood sample to test for DNA against the rape kits. Like, that sounds like, oh, yay, so they're going to find him. It didn't quite work out like that. The sample was sent to the Center of Forensics in Toronto and sat on a shelf with other samples waiting to be tested. So it,
yeah, it was part of a backlog.
Yes. And it's also when DNA was like kind of in its infancy because it was 1990. Like it had just been, you know, they just started using it. It was around this time, which it was actually July 1990, that Paul decided to move to St. Catharines to be with Carla. And they lived at her parents' house. Not long after his arrival, though, there was a rash of rapes in the St. Catharines area.
Yeah. So, probably not a coincidence.
Exactly. So, this next part, I'm going to do a super baked warning.
Today's episode of the podcast is rated SB for super baked. Make sure you load those bowls to the max. This shit is considerably depressing.
So, Paul had developed a liking for Carla's younger sister, Tammy.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and he had a gross fascination with her virginity.
Oh, no. How old was she?
She was 15. Yes, 15.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And Carla was aware of this and even a little jealous of the attention he gave Tammy. This is
that gross. Is not the correct reaction to have to that.
No, it's not.
Like, I know emotions and reactions are subjective, but that is objectively wrong.
I agree with you there. It's about to get a whole lot worse. So there was a time where Tammy and Paul had made out in the past when she was drunk, which again is an adult man kissing a child when she's inebriated. And Paul started sneaking into her room to masturbate at night.
Oh, that's so disgusting.
Yeah, it gets worse. Carla even broke the window lock so he could gain access because she was on board for him creeping on her sister.
That is not okay, Carla.
No, it is not. So, December 23rd, 1990, Carla told Paul she was gifting him Tammy's virginity for Christmas.
That is so disgusting.
Yeah. So that was his present. That night.
That's your little sister. You need to protect her.
Yeah, she does not do that. She's the worst sister in history.
Ooh, yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah.
DW is a close second.
From Arthur?
Yes.
You can go on your Arthur rant later, Rex.
She wouldn't sell Arthur out, though. That's why she's second.
That night after the family had gone to bed, Paul and Carla plied Tammy with alcohol laced with Halcedon, which were sleeping pills. By this time, Carla worked for a vet, and she took some Halothane from the clinic to keep Tammy unconscious during their assault. She put the Halothane on a rag, similar to how chloroform's used in movies, and then the couple proceeded to take turns raping the 15-year-old while the other one filmed it.
Oh, no, that's...
It's bad.
Ugh.
That's why it's super baked.
Like, ew. That's wrong on so many dimensions it's and so levels.
I know, because there's child rape and incest, and it gets worse. So while unconscious, Tammy vomited and choked on the vomit. When this happened, they dressed her, put away the video camera, and called 911. They told EMTs they had found her passed out after drinking and tried to revive her, which that's not true. Coroners decide.
Obviously.
Yeah. And it killed her. So now Tammy has died. And coroners decide, even though she has a burn mark from the Halothane by her mouth, that she died of natural causes and an accidental death. And Carla and Paul told police and medical personnel it was a rug burn from trying to revive her. But that's how she got the burns by her mouth.
So what medical causes would, or what natural causes would cause her to die, coroner?
Yeah, I don't understand why they said that. It was accidental, but it was natural causes in an accidental death.
Like, usually you would hyphen that with, like, stroke or heart attack.
Yeah.
Or something else that killed you that I can't think of.
That's just how they do it in Ontario. You die of accidents by natural causes.
They don't want to get too gruesome in Canada.
Yeah. Eventually, the couple moves into their own house in Port Delawise, away from the Homolka family. By this time, months had passed since Paul gave the police a blood sample, and they still hadn't tested it. So this emboldened him to commit more crimes, since he felt powerful and like he was smarter than the police, which is that classic psychopath and narcissist.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, I've outsmarted them. I can do whatever I want now.
Yeah, they're never going to catch me.
Exactly. And then his favorite book was American Psycho by Bret Easton Ellis, which came out in 91. And it said he read it like a Bible, that was the book he liked to obsess over. And I don't remember if Carla was into that book or not. I want to say she was, that they were both into it, but I know he was super duper into it.
Sounds like a movie, American Psycho.
That is a movie with Batman in it. And
Batman makes an appearance in it.
Yeah, Christian Bale.
I couldn't think of his name for a second. I'm more disappointed that it is not, in fact, Batman.
No, it's not. It's not Val Kilmer either. I can just name all the Batmans now. But I'm not going to do that. We're going to get back to my story. June 15th, 1991. Leslie Mahaffey was a 14-year-old student from Burlington, Ontario. After attending a wake for a friend who passed in a car wreck, she joined her peers in the woods for some drinks. Once they finished, she had some friends walk home with her and even goes to a payphone down the street to call another friend to see if she could sleep over. And you probably want me to explain what a payphone is, don't you?
I just want to add that Val Kilmer is on the cover of the book American Psycho. Go to Wikipedia, look it up.
What?
It's there.
Nuh-uh. I didn't know that. I was just thinking of Batman.
But Christian Bale is
the one in the movie.
Yeah, so two Batmans.
Oh wow.
Are an American Psycho.
I must be psychic. How'd I guess the right Batman?
Yeah, that's kind of creepy. Lindsay, tell us what a payphone is.
Payphones are before we had cell phones, when you were out and about and needed to call someone, you went to a little stall and picked up the phone and put in coins you paid to use the phone. Or you called collect and made the person pay.
Yeah, you nailed it. That's pretty much a payphone.
Yeah, so that's a payphone. She used one of those and asked a friend if she could sleep over, and they said no. So when they declined...
Oh, rude.
Yeah. She walked back home to realize her parents had locked her out of the house. It was in the middle of the night, and Paul spotted her in her yard. He convinced her to come over to the car, offering her a cigarette. And then when she was close to the vehicle, he forced her in. He took her back home to Carla, and he said he wanted to keep her as a sex slave.
Oh, let me guess where this is going. She also turned on her mother.
Who turned on her mother?
Carla.
On Carla's mother?
Did he kidnap Carla's mother?
No, he kidnapped a 14... Kidnapped it.
Okay, I'm sorry. I heard mother in there somewhere.
He kidnapped a 14-year-old student named Leslie Mahaffey.
Okay.
Together, over the next 24 hours, they assaulted her while filming it. Both have since claimed that her death was an accident, since they again used drugs from Carla's work to keep her sedated during the attacks. They also said that they gave her a teddy bear to hold in between attacks. Fucked up.
And aside from that, they didn't learn about their chemicals causing literal death.
Yeah, they just are like, well, let's try it again.
I mean, we didn't get caught the first time. Might as well just kill another one.
Exactly. So this one, again, they're saying it was an accident. There's a section in my book that I read, because there were a few sections that covered them in Peter Vronsky's Serial Killers, The Method and Madness of Monsters. But there's a section in that book called Never Get Into the Car, and it describes Leslie's rape, abduction, and murder. And it also said, and parents, don't lock your children out of the house at night, which I thought was another important point.
That is very good advice.
Yeah.
Please do not abandon your children, parents.
Yeah, well, it was 91, so it was more accepted back then.
The parenting bar was a little lower back then.
Yeah. So the next day, they moved her body to the basement of their home so they could entertain Carla's family on the main level. Carla made sure to keep her mother from going downstairs. And then once the family left, they proceeded to use a circular saw for dismembering and encasing Leslie's remains in concrete. And then they dumped the pieces into Lake Gibson.
So they didn't get caught.
Exactly. So 2 weeks later, June 29th, 1991, Paul and Carla had a fairy tale wedding. I'm using air quotes there. Complete with a horse-drawn carriage to take them away from the church. And if you watch a documentary on them, there's always a picture of them that's like they're in the back of a car on their wedding day. And it's very, like, you can tell it's very early 90s. She has, like, bleach blonde fluffy hair. And he has, like, bleach blonde fluffy hair. And it's a lot of Aquanet.
Aquanet is for the younger viewers.
It's some strong-ass hairspray.
Basically hair glue. And incredibly flammable.
Yes, it is.
So I'm not sure you can buy it anymore.
They still make it. They still make it. I swear. I actually have a can of it.
I mean, in a pinch, it makes for great butane.
It does. You should light a dab rig with that. But don't really do that. Please don't do that.
Yeah. That's so we don't get sued.
Yeah. We're going to leave that part in. Okay, so that same day, 16 miles away, the same day as their wedding, a fisherman discovers Leslie's remains, and then she was identified by her dental appliances, like her braces, which is heartbreaking because, again, she was a 14-year-old who was tortured and murdered and thrown in a lake.
Leave her any dignity.
Yeah. So one thing they did more than once, which is another gross thing, Carla would invite Tammy's friends over for drinks, lace them with sleeping pills, and assault the girls while they were passed out. They also filmed these happenings, and that's how one girl found out that she got assaulted by them, because when the police had the videos, she was identified in a video, but her name is Jane Doe in the case when they were charged, so her identity's never been released, which I don't blame her on that.
Not at all.
Yeah. So the victims had no recollection of the events in that. Like, she didn't know the police are the ones who told her she had been assaulted.
So she basically found out by watching the video.
Yeah. And I don't know if she watched it or if they had, or I wonder if they had to confirm her identity. Oh, God.
Imagine finding out that way. That's so humiliating.
Yeah. It would be the worst. Oh, God. That poor girl.
Yeah, that's awful.
It is. April 16th, 1992, a 15-year-old student from St. Catharines was walking home from school when Carla and Paul abducted her in broad daylight. Carla got her attention by placing a paper map on the roof of her car, asking for directions. And for our younger listeners... A paper map is what you use for Google Maps.
Or Apple Maps.
I know I use Apple Maps and I just still said Google Maps.
Or MapQuest.
If you're 65 and older, yeah, you definitely use MapQuest.
MapQuest was the shit in the mid-2000s, okay?
It was at one point, yes. I will agree with you on that. They asked her for directions, you know, acted like they were lost. Once Kristen approached the car, Carla shoved her into the back seat. Nobody reported anything amiss except one witness who recalled seeing someone, quote, struggling to put a big package on their back seat, end quote. She was, again, kidnapped in broad daylight. They kept Kristen in captivity for 3 days. They forced her to drink copious amounts of alcohol, raping her, beating her, and forcing her into sexual humiliation. They filmed all of this as well, but not her murder. Paul strangled her on April 19th, 1992, and they dumped her body along the side of a road.
Ugh.
Yeah. Kristen's... So
they bypassed the chemical method and just went more direct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He escalated by that point and was just strangling her.
Might as well just kill them.
Yes. So Kristen's school used the Green Ribbon of Hope as a symbol for their missing child search. And this is a quote about the Green Ribbon of Hope. French's school community also gave the name to the Green Ribbon of Hope campaign, a national campaign continued by Child Find Canada, governments, organizations, and individuals to raise funds and awareness for missing children. So that's what the Green Ribbon of Hope is for.
That's so nice.
Mm-hmm. She was originally a missing child. They, you know, until they found her body. So the Toronto police formed a Green Ribbon task force to look for her killer after her body was discovered on April 30th. So it was like 2 weeks went by before they found her. They brought in Greg McCreary from the FBI, and he had previously covered the Scarborough rape case and linked the two. He was in one of the documentaries that I watched. They have had a string of rapes in Scarborough and what's dubbed, quote, the schoolgirl murders near St. Catharines, which that would be Leslie and Kristen, both of them. Those were the schoolgirl murders. McCreary had no knowledge of the rapes in St. Catharines, the ones that picked up as soon as Paul moved there. He didn't even know about that. Otherwise, he would have connected that to the Scarborough rapist and the person responsible for the schoolgirl. Let's try this.
Schoolgirls.
Schoolgirl murders.
Schoolgirl murders.
Yes, but he releases a profile. So the profile of their predator is a white male, late 20s, with a history of domestic violence. And the task force had no idea that it was more than one person, much less a couple, you know.
So they thought it was just one male.
Yes.
Well, they're about to be in for a surprise, aren't they?
Yes. After Kristen French went missing, but before the Green Ribbon Task Force released info, the media started reporting on a serial predator, and after her body was discovered, a serial killer on the loose. Since they received so little information from the police, media outlets started airing reports of their own theories, and it turned into a circus. The case was heavily covered in Canadian and American media, and the Americans are the ones who dubbed them the Barbie and Ken killers after they got caught.
Yeah, because of the bleach blonde hair.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they
It's not a good look for anyone.
No, it's really not.
Much less serial rapists than serial killers.
Yes. It looks the worst on them because they're shitty. December 92. Carla and Paul applied to have their surnames legally changed to Teale, and it's T-E-A-L-E, which they got from a 1988 movie, Criminal Law, where there's a serial killer named Teale. Because, I don't know, they think they're cute. And then...
They just don't know subtlety, do they?
No, they don't.
They love shoving things in people's faces.
I know, like their fucking hair.
Narcissists.
12/27/1993. This is when it all comes crashing down. Paul and Carla got into a fight and he beat the shit out of her. So she had two black eyes, broken ribs, and other injuries. She went to the hospital and the police. And then in that same month, 2 years after giving the sample, the DNA finally came back from the rape kits on Scarborough Rapist, and they matched it to Paul Bernardo. So the police call Carla to inform her, like, hey, your husband's a Scarborough Rapist. And she comes in for questioning. And when they were questioning her, she assumed the police knew about her involvement with the murders of her sister and the two other girls. So she makes a deal. And this is the infamous, quote, deal with the devil that made this case. Carla told them she was a victim in this too, that Paul was controlling and sexually deviant, and he committed these atrocities, and she even has the tapes to prove it. Yeah. So the Crown didn't really have a case against him for the murders of Tammy Homolka, Leslie Mahaffey, and Kristen French. They had evidence for the Scarborough rapist and knew it was most likely the same individual that committed these crimes. But otherwise, they didn't have a case without her testimony. And then, of course, these tapes she's talking about.
So were the other crimes, did the bodies not have DNA evidence in them?
I'm guessing not, or they weren't, like, scraping for it. But, oh, you would think, yeah, the rape kits on... Right. Well, they didn't do one on Tammy because they had no idea. They thought she was just had passed out drunk. They didn't even check that. And then on the other two girls, Leslie was dismembered and encased in concrete, so they couldn't check there. And then Kristen, they dumped her on the side of the road. Too badly
decomposed.
Oh, possibly, yeah, especially in 92, when, okay, again, DNA is in its infancy still. They needed her testimony. So in exchange for her testimony and tapes, Carla was only sentenced to 12 years in prison on 2 counts of manslaughter. And then she got off
way too easy.
Oh, yes. That's why this one pisses me off so much. She filed for divorce in prison in 94. There was a publication ban on Carla's trial to preserve Paul's right to a fair trial. So Paul's original lawyer kept the tapes from the prosecution for 17 months. So they didn't see them before they made the deal with Homolka.
So they probably wouldn't have offered her a deal if they had those tapes.
They said if they had seen those tapes before, they would have never offered her that deal. At both,
and it was only because of the publication ban that they weren't able to get the tapes.
And also, the lawyer kept them for 17 months without sharing them with the prosecution.
Isn't that illegal?
Apparently not in Canada. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer, Rexus.
Come on, Canada.
At both of their trials, the tapes were played, and they showed Carla had a very active role in the assaults and was a willing participant, not a helpless victim. Paul was shown forcing them to call him master or king and saying, "Tell me you love me." Which says a lot about him as well.
Narcissist!
Just a tad. It was too late to go back on the deal, so she served her sentence and was released on July 4th, 2005. She had a child a few years later. She moved to Guadalupe and Antilles, then back to Canada. She originally settled in Quebec to start over in the French-speaking community in 2005, and then after she went to a few different countries... In 2014, she moved back to Quebec, and then she's changed her name and remarried and claims to still have nightmares about the girls, which she deserves. So, but she gave a TV interview in 2008, and that's when she had said that. Now,
Paul was trying to drum up sympathy for her.
Yeah. Fuck her.
Yeah, she deserves every single nightmare she gets.
Yes. And I saw on Reddit, like last year, I want to say, there was a picture of her going around at her kid's school because she's a registered sex offender. She's not allowed to be near schools. And she was volunteering at her kid's school for something. So I remember that happening.
So she should have been arrested for that.
Yeah, but she wasn't. Paul was convicted of 13 plus rapes, 6 attempted rapes, sexual assault, torture, and 3 murders. He was declared a, quote, dangerous offender in 1995, so he will most likely never be released. He was interviewed again by police in 2006 from prison and admitted to more rapes. And I watched his police video on that. The new admissions led to the release of men serving for the crimes he's committed, like Anthony Hainmaker, Hainmayer. God damn it, I'm so sorry, Anthony Hainmayer.
This poor Anthony. Not only is he falsely accused, we keep butchering his name.
But now some stupid podcast is butchering his name.
This is surely going to keep him up at night.
Yes, I'm so sorry. So he's still a psychopath. He seemed personally offended by what the newspapers reported the police saying about him. Like, they were questioning on his gruesome crimes. And he was just like, well, you guys, you lied to me. Like, why'd you say this about me? And he is just... He's upset about that. So he became
ill. You guys tell the truth about me.
Yeah, exactly. And he was like getting real personal with the Mounties he was talking to. He's like, why'd you say that? Why'd you say that? And it's just like, shut up. You raped and murdered so many people. Just shut up.
He likes attention.
Yes, just a little bit. He became eligible for parole in 2018 and was denied. yeah, some good that came out of this, because this is a devastating story, and especially with Carla being out free living her life. The good that came out of it, now Ontario has an automated case filing computer system unlike any in the world. It's called PowerCase, and all the municipal police services and Ontario Provincial Police have had access since 2002. This helps to not have as many predators fall through the cracks of the system like Bernardo did for so many years. And there are memorials for Kristen French and Leslie Mahaffey at their respective schools and in their towns.
That's great. Those little girls deserve that.
Yes, they do. Because they definitely did not deserve what happened to them.
No.
So that was my story about the Barbie and Ken killer, Carla Homolka, and Paul Bernardo.
Well, thank you for sharing that with me, Lindsay.
You're welcome. That was
very interesting.
Yes. So we are going to enjoy another round of cannabis and come back so Rex can tell us the story about another killer couple.
Well, we are back and we are baked. So yay. I also have a killer couple story for you.
Yes.
All right. So my couple, their names are Ray and Faye Copeland.
How cute.
And from that, you could probably guess that they are pretty Midwestern.
Mm-hmm.
And you would be correct. They had a farm in Chillicothe, Missouri.
Ooh. Is that a Native American name?
Sure. Oh. Chillicothe is Shawnee for big town.
Is it really?
It
Did
is.
You look it up?
I oh. knew that. I took detailed notes on Chillicothe.
Are you just fucking with me? I don't believe you now.
So Chillicothe is a town in northwestern Missouri. And in 1980/1990, it had around 9,000 people.
Okay.
So it was a very small town.
Yeah.
Such that everyone clearly knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
Ray and Faye, as everyone in town knew them, were elderly, and they mainly kept to themselves. Faye was a hotel maid slash, later in life, she was a factory worker.
Mm-hmm.
Her philosophy for couples, the theme of this podcast, is once you're married to someone, you stay with them no matter what.
She's what you call old fashioned.
That is correct. I think in one of the documentaries I watched, her son even said as much as that. Oh. By the way, these documentaries are also very Midwestern.
Oh, nice. Like when I watched the Kentucky Vampire one.
Very methy, I imagined.
Oh, probably.
So that part is kind of important because Ray would regularly abuse the shit out of Faye.
Oh.
And her son mentioned that when he and his wife sometimes visited his parents, that she would regularly have a black eye.
Aww.
But they already knew that Ray was a terrible person because he would regularly beat his children.
Oh, God.
As an example, he beat one of his sons for kicking over a bucket of milk accidentally.
Aww.
And he beat him with these metal cow kickers.
Oh, what the fuck?
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
So his children said that they sort of had a good childhood with their mother. Not so much with their father.
You don't say. The guy that beat you with a cow poker or whatever it was is kickers. Not a good dad. Cow kicker? What's all that sad too? This is just the tragedy farm.
That's just old fashioned parenting though.
Yeah.
A Midwestern style. So Ray was the one that needed to hire people to work around the farm once his children grew up and left the farm. And so he would usually go to the local missions around town because he could only offer them $50 in room and board. And they ate that offer up because they were homeless.
Yeah.
They didn't have anywhere to stay. And this guy comes around offering money and a free place to stay and free meals.
Yeah, it sounds like true.
How would you turn that down?
Yeah, that would definitely be hard.
Criminally in the case, in fall of 1986, Dennis Murphy went missing.
Okay.
And so the police knew that
Ray had hired Dennis Murphy to work.
Mm-hmm.
But Ray just told him, and the police were just like, oh, okay.
Makes enough sense to me.
Alibi checks out. We did all we could. The thing about Dennis Murphy, though, was he was one of seven men that were missing and wanted for bad check writing.
Ooh. They seem to be connected.
Yes, maybe we'll get a nice connection / segue here soon. No, we actually won't. Sorry. 1989. This guy called Jack McCormick calls the Nebraska police and he tells them that he found human bones on Ray's farm.
Ooh.
Jack McCormick was one of the people that Ray hired.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was his connection to Ray's farm. The police kind of already knew about Jack McCormick, that he was kind of like a transient drunk.
Yeah.
And so he wasn't super reliable, but human remains is a pretty grave accusation.
Yeah, I'd say so.
So they go ahead and they search his farm anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So they're tearing it up. They're digging. They have bloodhounds. And the search goes on. They sure did. Because they were a small town in Missouri. Like, shit like this didn't happen.
Yeah. Was it a place where they didn't even lock their doors at night? Was it one of those?
I mean, did the 1980s Midwest not give that away?
I imagine that's how every documentary you watched on it started.
Did the everybody knew each other not give it away? Yeah.
Well, goddamn, that's Phil. He's breaking in again.
Crazy old Phil. In October of 1989, Ray and his wife, Faye, are arrested for conspiracy.
Mm. Conspiracy to what?
To commit murder based on Jack's accusations.
Oh, that one. That old chestnut.
Yeah, yes. So the search is going on for 9 days. The police have two people arrested. The media coverage is hysterical.
I bet.
And then they can't find anything.
Like, so they didn't find bodies?
And they found no bodies on Ray and Faye's farm.
Mm.
And then they bring Jack to the farm because he's their only lead at the moment.
Mm-hmm. And he's the one who said there's bones in them, their heels.
That's right. And so they're like, hey, Jack, where are dem bones in dem heels? And so Jack kind of walks around the farm. And then after a while, he ends up telling the police that he actually didn't see any bones.
What the fuck? Then why? Go on. Why did he say he saw bones?
So what happened with Jack and Ray? That's a very good question because that leads into their relationship.
Okay.
So Jack, after he had called the police, they had brought him in for an interview. Mm-hmm. Jack had said Ray gave him a P.O. box and he took him to a bank, mm-hmm. gave him money to start a checking account, and then took him to cattle auctions around the state.
Oh, I remember this Forensic Files now. It was the cattle auction fraud one.
That's right.
Okay.
So they would buy the cattle and they would write checks. And to our younger listeners,
I still write
electronic
checks.
Electronic.
They know what those are. You can still pay bills with checks.
Huh, really?
Yes.
Okay. So checks are non-electronic forms of payments because those weren't available in the 1980s. And so it would have your bank account number on the check so that they knew where to withdraw the money from.
And they still do.
And you would write how much money. And you still do all of this, apparently.
They still have a routing number, a checking number, and then a check number.
I mean, I also do have checks for, like, when I need home repairs. They're convenient for that. But the main important thing about that is that checks don't immediately clear.
Right.
So, they would write a few checks for the cattle. Some of them would clear, and so they would gain some credibility.
Mm.
And then they would get the big dogs, and they would close the account that same day.
Oh.
And Jack really didn't like this. So on top of this, one night, Ray tells Jack to go out to the barn because there's a raccoon in the barn.
It's a trap. It's a trap.
Yeah. You can see this coming from a mile away. From the person that beats their children over small things.
Yeah, I wonder what he would be doing with that barn.
Jack's looking for the raccoon, turns around, looks at Ray. Ray has his bolt-action 22 pointed at Jack.
Uh-oh.
Jack doesn't like this either, so this is kind of two strikes against Ray at this point.
A couple of red flags.
Jack says he won't tell anyone about this if Ray lets him go. Ray lets him go. And then Jack just leaves Missouri for 5 months. And then the police just kind of found him in a ditch, I think in Nebraska.
Jack?
Yeah, from drinking too much.
Oh. So Ray didn't kill him. He killed him himself with drinking.
Oh no, he was still alive.
Oh, okay.
He had just passed out, apparently.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant he was dead in a ditch.
No.
Okay.
I don't know where this ties into the interview or his phone call, to be honest, though. It's just kind of like a funny part of the story that they just randomly find him drunk on the on the literal side of the road.
Yes. Our Mr. Credible source who lies about human remains, but does know that Ray is crazy, son of a gun.
So these are the accusations that land Ray and Faye the conspiracy charges for murder. And then the police learned, after these 9 days, that Ray worked on other farms in the city. So they start poking the grounds of these farms with a steel rod to see if there's any loose dirt from, you know, like, buried bodies.
Yeah. From burying a body or two.
And then at one of the farms, they end up finding 3 bodies.
Oh.
These bodies are those of James.
Is it like Anthony Haymayer all over again? Haymayer?
No, I just...
Haymayer.
I just scribbled these shits. Okay. They found James...
You can't read your doctor writing? Your chicken scratch?
No, I can't. Chicken scratch is, like, really... That's a really nice way of putting it. The police find three bodies. Those of James Harvey, age 27, John Freeman, age 27, and Paul Cowart, age 21.
Ooh, he was young.
These guys were just transients that Ray had gotten from the local missions, and so... That's why the police had never really investigated their murders, because no one is really missing them.
Right.
So after they find these three bodies, they have all the evidence they need to charge Ray and Faye with three murders.
Okay.
And so they start talking to Ray, who they let him know, hey, we found these three bodies and we know you did it.
Mm-hmm.
So the police search another farm that they worked on, that he worked on. They find another body, who is Wayne Warner. Does not have an age, apparently. They didn't know how old he was.
Oh. Okay. Sorry, Wayne.
Yeah, sorry, Wayne Warner of Bloomington, Illinois. And then they find, they start talking to Ray in the interview, and they'd say, hey, we found these four bodies. We know you did it.
Yeah.
And so Ray thinks that he can play coy a little bit. And he says, hey, guys, I was in this restaurant and listening to these three guys at this other table. And they were talking about how they killed this guy and threw him down the well at this location.
How convenient.
Who would believe that story?
I just happened to be there when they were discussing it.
It was a very compelling story.
Yes. I had to listen in.
And so police go to that well and they find the body of Dennis Murphy. Okay. Who we also do not have an H for. Sorry, Dennis Murphy of Normal, Illinois. And so that ties back to the original first person that was missing that were involved in these check writing fraud schemes.
Okay.
After the police had arrested Ray and Faye, they started to interview them. As murder cases usually progress. They started with Faye, and she would not cooperate with the police whatsoever.
Oh, she's sticking by Ray till the end.
She once you marry someone, you're with them till the end, Lindsay. No matter what. They kept questioning Faye. And she was very defensive about Ray and questioning why he even needed to kill people.
Yeah.
Because they were still getting by day to day just fine. So after they kind of give up these first rounds of interviews. But as the police were searching their house, they found men's clothing with name tags.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's right. Oh, by the way, matched the names of these missing and murdered transients. They also found a quilt of these men's clothing that Faye had sewn together.
That's not creepy at all.
Yeah, that's weird. Like, I get if you have sewing as a hobby, but can you not do it from murdered people's clothing?
Yeah, your victim's clothes. Oh, God. The Tragedy Farm quilt.
Another key piece of evidence that the police were able to pin against Faye was a list in her handwriting.
Oh.
With the names of all these different missing people. And there is an X next to the dead names.
Oh.
So that was probably the most damning piece of evidence.
I'd say so.
For Ray and Faye. Additionally, each skull had bullets matching Ray's rifle.
Yeah. That makes him look pretty guilty.
I would say so. The police were able to match Faye's handwriting because she wrote him a letter in prison.
Oh.
And so they matched the handwriting between that letter and the list of dead people.
Nice. Good job, cops.
Another reason that the police thought that Faye was guilty was because in her letter, she wrote, "Nothing found, nothing gained, things will cool down."
But a nice little mantra.
And that was written before any bodies were found.
Oh.
So the nothing found kind of strikes a little more nefarious.
Oh, because she thinks she's sneaky and got away with it.
Right. So it's at this point, it's kind of hard to believe that she didn't know about it.
Yeah.
Ray's abusive behavior towards her notwithstanding.
Right.
And so that was basically the main reason that both Faye and Ray were convicted of the murders of these people. The prosecution was able to allege successfully that Ray would write checks for cattle
mm-hmm.
at these auctions that would not clear in the transients' names. And before the transients could tell anyone or get reimbursed for that money, Ray would kill them in the back of the head with a bolt-action rifle.
Oh.
So Faye was actually tried first.
Mm-hmm.
Her main defense was that she was an abused wife, obviously.
Right.
She would not testify against Ray.
Oh.
So that kind of really doomed her.
Yeah.
Her son has said that she was terrified of him.
Well, I imagine she was.
So even him within the confines of the prison, she still wouldn't turn on him. That's how psychologically he had gotten to her.
Well, and I forgot to even say this on mine. Carla tried to do battered wife syndrome. She tried to use that in her defense, but she wasn't. But I would say that Faye actually was a battered wife and who's terrified to not obey her husband. Like, she would more fit that category.
When their children are saying that she got black eyes.
Yeah.
Probably coming from Ray, I would.
Exactly.
Probably coming from the very angry man that she was married to.
Yeah. That would be terrifying.
That beat his children.
Yeah. Ugh. Piece of shit.
Either the defense or the state assigned a psychologist
mm-hmm.
to Faye. She did say eventually that Ray was physically abusive.
Yeah.
She...
You can't read it, can you?
It's so bad. Okay.
It's okay. I'm pretty baked. It's entertaining.
When Ray was first married to Faye, this all came out from the psychologist session, so they kind of seem a little non sequitur.
Mm-hmm.
But these are just different things about Ray that eventually came out from these sessions.
Okay.
So... like I already said, she said that he was physically abusive.
Mm-hmm.
She said that shortly after they were first married,
mm-hmm.
she had hired Faye's dad to do work on the farm. And eventually, when it came time for payment, he didn't pay her dad.
Oh.
He also stole food from Faye's parents. This one's pretty sad. He tried to rape her sister.
Oh, God. Raided?
Raided?
Yeah. Ugh.
And she's still stuck with him.
Ugh. Yeah, both of our killer couples had some parallels there.
Yeah. Faye still wouldn't turn against Dre, though. Faye was convicted of 4 counts of murder and 1 count of manslaughter.
Okay.
In November of 1990. Ray was convicted of 5 counts of murder and sentenced to the death penalty.
Oh, wow.
Faye was also sentenced to the death penalty.
Okay.
Eventually... Oh, fun fact.
Yes.
When Ray had heard that Faye had been sentenced to death, he replied, "Well, those things happen to some, you know."
What the fuck? It just happened.
She still stuck by him.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Ray never got carried out with the death penalty because he died of natural causes. Because
he was old as shit.
So he died on October 1993 at the ripe age of 78.
Oh. Well, so he's gone. Is Faye still with us? Or?
So Faye's attorneys, after Ray died... Mm-hmm. They appealed her conviction because they weren't able to tell the jury about Faye's abuse. Mm-hmm. Because, oh, by the way, the psychologist for Faye was not allowed to testify because they had incorrect paperwork.
Oh, that sucks.
So... there is absolutely no evidence of Ray's marital abuse at the trial.
Oh, that would make a big difference.
Right, so that's why her attorneys appealed. So on October 6th, 1999, Judge Autry Smith overturned her death penalty. But he still commuted... her death sentence to life without parole.
Wow. Okay.
So, again...
is she still alive or has she since? Because isn't she up there in the years too?
Right. So, on August 10th, 2002, Faye suffered a stroke. And she was actually sent to a nursing home in her hometown... in order to live out the rest of her life in her in Chillicothe, Missouri.
Well,
she died in 2003 at the ripe age of 82.
Well, she outlived the bastard by a few years.
So in the end, she got the last laugh. Look. Say what you will about Faye Copeland. She probably knew about Ray's murders. But even if she didn't, she was still a victim of domestic abuse. And that's not okay. We're going to list the National Domestic Violence Hotline. Because no one deserves to be a victim, and there is help available 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE, which is 7233. These calls are available in more than 200 languages, and they are free and completely confidential.
Thank you for that, Rex. Thank you for joining me, Rex. Thank you for listening. And you can email us at bakedpotatopodcast@gmail.com and follow us on Instagram @bakedpotatopodcast.
You're welcome. Thank you for listening.
Yeah. Thank you for listening.
Check out our Instagram,
where I'm an endearing idiot.
Yes. But our favorite endearing idiot.
Oh, yes.